Probably wall someday. She stands, hands on hips. Are you fucking insane? He can't meet her gaze. He looks at paint dots on the floor. If you can't accept me sitting, if you're that possessive for my body, be upfront about it. I didn't mean to have a big argument. Really? No? She unhooks her bra, throws it at her pile of clothing. She pushes down her panties, lets them fall to her ankles. What are you kids arguing over? Bear asks, indifferent to her nudity. What do you mean, objectifying? Not women's lib jazz, is it? Well, you do only paint women, she responds. You're supposed to be this master of empathy who captures women so deeply, but a woman's hip is the sum of her? You gotta see how reductive that is. Could you put something on? Pinch pleads, unable to look at her. Honey, I've been married 5 times, okay? Does that sound like a man who doesn't like the opposite sex? And I never painted a lady for the purposes of laying her. Hell, if I went to bed with sitters, it was to make for better paintings, not the other way around. Some of your wives were artists, including his mother. How did that go for her? Aghast, Pinch stares at Barrows. I never put it that way. She's distorting this. Barrows adds, the women's movement hasn't exactly landed in the art world, am I wrong? What's that line? When a woman makes dinner, she's a cook. When a man does, he's a chef? What in hell are you talking about? Bear says. You're trying to hang some sort of slander on my father on a lifetime of serious work. Actually, we're just talking, she says, as if to a moron, gathering her clothing, which she holds in a bunch before her. Right, Bear? Or are you above the critical consensus? That's exactly what I am. The only people who get tingles over what critics say is a breed of people known as critics. Whatever floats your boat, Mr. Bear, you and Rembrandt gazing from your canvases for the edification of future generations, right? Let me guess, you fancy yourself a critic someday. I wouldn't mind. Well, tell me something, young lady. You ever seen the paintings of Gabriel von Max? No, why? Track them down. What I recommend is monkeys as art critics. And that, she says, proves my point. How so? Because I never heard of the guy. He doesn't count, and neither do you. 36. Once alone in the cottage, Pinch and Barrows fight in hushed voices. I wasn't attacking anyone, and he should be grown up enough to handle it. Anyway, you seem to be the one who's offended. Don't tell me what he is or isn't, Pinch attempts, unable to keep up, unsure of his own views, just hanging on, terrified of what is happening, her every glance seeming to shout, goodbye. We're enjoying his hospitality, remember? I'll leave then, she responds. And seriously, if you're incapable of discussing controversy without taking it personally, you will struggle in academia. You'll struggle at anything. The NYU admissions panel definitely got it right. Thank you. Thanks. I'm very sorry, but it's hard for me to respect a grown man who acts like a worshipful little boy around his father. Flushing, he stands there, pointing at her, speechless. What is that supposed to mean? She asks. Fuck you. They lie in the dark for hours, neither able to sleep. Before dawn, she whispers, I'm going. We'll discuss it in the morning. He pretends to fall asleep, but is lying there, sweating, scrambling for a way back. At breakfast, Barrows tells Bear that she needs to leave because of an emergency back home, though it's preposterous that she could have learnt such news with no telephone out here. As she packs, Pinch stares at a window ledge dotted with dead insects. We came all the way here. I haven't forgotten that you paid for everything. That's not my point. Seemingly, if you pay the bills, I'm your chattel. He slams the window closed, its latch shuddering, and points at her again, finger trembling. You're insane. She raises her eyebrows as if to a third party. Barrows zips up her luggage. She lugs the suitcase outside, rebuffing his offers of help. You can't thumb a ride from here to Paris, he says. Take the car if you're going, but please, can we talk for a second? We did talk. I lost my temper. I don't know. She drops her suitcase on the gravel, looks at him, hatred draining away. Don't swear at me again, okay? Please. He takes a half step closer. Barrows, just
hitting the road?
Bear calls out, tromping down from the studio.
An early start is always best.
He passes them, pops the front boot on the Beetle, drops her suitcase in and slams the bonnet, then hoists Barrows off the ground for a farewell peck on the cheek. Looking away, she expresses chilly thanks and slides into the driver's seat. She doesn't start the engine, instead staring through the closed window at Pinch, eyes wide. Can we talk? Bear taps the roof twice, giving her a thumbs up, She starts the engine but remains in place, the exhaust cloud billowing. Pinch steps forward but is tugged aside by his father for a private huddle.
You, Charlie boy, Bear assures him, are another class from that girl.
Slowly the Beetle is reversing down the driveway, tires spitting up the stones and dust. Sharply, Pinch turns from his father, trying to catch her eye but only squinting at the glint on the windscreen. Bear waves at her in a semaphore sweep while addressing his son.
Better off without her, kiddo, he says,
holding Pinch in a one-armed hug.
We're better off without her.
Toronto. 37. After flinging his suitcase into the house, Pinch sets out to find Barrows. When she drove away from the cottage, he had no way to reach her, so awaited their flight home, spending 10 more days alongside Bear, who cavorted and socialized and never mentioned their departed guest. Each night, Pinch lies under the cottage rafters, head spinning from too much alcohol, tortured by the recollected spat, rehearsing what he'd say when he met Barrows at the airport. Once it was time to leave, he travelled by train and ferry back to Britain, almost forgetting that he promised to see his mother. But he couldn't face that. Couldn't bolster her. So he went directly to Heathrow. At the departure gate, he searched everywhere.
Sorry, the airline rep told him finally. That person's name is not on your flight.
The housemate answers the door, peering disdainfully over her glasses when he asks for Barrows.
Scylla isn't living here anymore.
Where did she go?
If she didn't tell you, I can't.
Did she leave for New York? I'm not in a position to tell you that information. The door closes. Pinch is back in his living room, clutching the briar pipe as tightly as possible, as if to crack the wood. In his other fist he holds a set of keys from the cottage that he forgot to return, clasping them so the metal cuts into his palm. He extends his arm, gazes down it, measuring proportions, suddenly behind an easel in the Roman art studio, his paintbrush moving, its course seeming to precede his intent for an instant. He bites the pipe bit as if to crack his teeth, then searches for a Latin textbook, running through vocabulary lists which strangely soothe him. He looks around. Could take a cook to New York, find her at the department. What would my argument be? I need you. Oh, that's not a case, that's a difference of opinions.
Whatever you like, he says aloud, addressing Barrows across the empty room. But this is a mistake.
For me, not for anybody else. Soon, tenants will arrive at his house. He always pledged to leave upon finishing his studies.
To go where?
Pinch covers his eyes, wanting to erase himself. In agitation, he phones directory inquiries to track down the number of the Institute of Fine Arts in New York, then asks the secretary there how to reach an incoming doctoral candidate. They won't pass on private details like that.
You're not hearing my point! He slams down the phone, telling the receiver, listen to what I'm saying!
He starts a letter to Barrows, but there was never any changing her mind. He resumes his pacing, hemmed in by moving boxes. How can he be trapped by a future that hasn't happened? He studies the wall, then hammer fists his stomach, wincing at each blow. He is saturated with hatred for someone who has nothing to do with this. Temple Butterfield, a fake who is far more consequential, far more important, far more successful than Natalie, than Pinch could ever be. CalArts accepted an idiot like him. He'd have to admit someone like me. How hard could admission be?
Very hard, Pinch imagines.
He marches into the bedroom that belonged to Marsden. He needs his friend here. The last report was that he'd moved to Los Angeles as a studio assistant at Temple. Pinch tracks down a fellow member of Marsden's college entourage and learns the full account. Apparently, Temple made a video piece, Fairy Dust, featuring Marsden yapping to a fixed camera about various seedy affairs, childhood gripes, vitriol towards his family, punctuated by cocaine snorts and campy tears, all edited in jump cuts with the goal of a laugh riot. Studio International called Temple's venture into video art both freakily hilarious and deadly serious, noting that its subject was a real person whose father was a member of the Canadian Parliament. In Ottawa, the Right Honourable Brian McClintock was shown excerpts of the film which outed Marsden, prompting much of his family to disavow him. When Marsden returned to Toronto, he was ostracized even by his gallery friends there, owing to bitchy on-camera remarks mocking the Canadian art scene, calling it easily a decade behind. Reached by phone, Marsden sounds suspicious to hear from Pinch, yet agrees to a drink at the St. Charles Tavern. He arrives 40 minutes late, hair platinum blonde now, a hoop earring, and with two older friends,
a mustachioed 50-something antiques dealer with mahogany tan and a veiny muscle man in a lime tank top who keeps massaging his neck to banish a kink. These two stare through Pinch, swiveling around for cuter guys, then visit the bathroom to snort a few lines. Marsden, froggish, eyelids fluttering, gazes across the table.
"I've heard the whole temple story," Pinch assures him. "I wondered if you might like a little commiseration."
"And here you are to provide it, just after the nick of time," Marsden says. "I assume you came to boast about something?"
"The reverse. Barris and I broke up, and my doctoral applications went nowhere. I've got to leave the house soon and have no idea where I'll go. I haven't told my parents any of this. I'm kind of spinning downhill. My only hope is some obscure fellowship that I applied for because of a pushy professor. So no, not here to boast." He picks at a beer mat.
"I'd actually just like to erase all this."
"All what?"
"All the things I've misplayed. I'm sorry, by the way," Pinch inserts tensely, unable to make eye contact, clearing his throat.
"I'd erase whole parts of me, throw them off a building, throw myself off a building." "Oh, please," Marsden says, standing in disgust. "Please."
He turns his back and joins his friends in the bathroom.
Heart thudding, Pinch holds still, humiliated. He stuffs a few dollars under the ashtray and takes a dozen steps along Young Street, fixing all attention on his feet to snuff out the shame. Someone calls his name. He turns, orienting to Marsden's voice.
"Jumping off a fucking building?" Marsden shouts, standing in the barroom door. "You are never doing something that stupid!"
"I know. You're not allowed,"
Marsden says, choking up.
"Okay, because I said, okay!"
He pushes back inside the tavern, vanishing in there, lost in darkness for years more. Evanlode, Pennsylvania, 1976. 38. Quakers founded Evanlode College almost a century before, but by the time Pinch arrives, little of that peaceable sect remains except in the name of varsity teams, the Quakes, whose furry mascot, Tembler, is everywhere on campus. Sweatshirts, bumper stickers, coffee mugs. Many of them themed with stars and stripes in this year of the American Bicentennial. Pinch explores his new college town, sidestepping flocks of drunken teens who stagger between a support system of frat houses, burger joints, drop-in clinics. Taking refuge in his one-bedroom rental, Pinch looks out of the window, a church sign across the road. Afterlife guaranteed.
Thank God, he thinks, that this fellowship lasts only 9 months.
He makes a showing at the department, introducing himself to Howie Sfinkles, sociology professor with high culture pretensions, who established the college's art history program in 1973. Vigorously, he shakes Pinch's hand, saying how he admires Bear Bavinsky.
"Now, I'll let you in on a little secret. All this rigmarole is nothing but a front for my wine club," he kids. "Imagine how excited I am to get an Italian speaker on board."
He drags out a case of Tuscan Reds and produces an Italian language wine guide, which Pinch is compelled to read aloud. He translates so well that Sfinkles declares,
"Forget that silly fellowship, Charles. Do your doctorate here."
Pinch smiles politely.
"I'm not joking,"
Sfinkles says.
"Wow,"
Pinch responds, appalled.
"Gosh, maybe."
Privately, he remains fixated on NYU, where he plans to transfer next year to join Barrows, even if she doesn't yet know. He'll require Sfinkles' reference to apply there. For now, Pinch must please the man. When they chat, he finds himself mimicking the professor's body language, arms folded, heel against the wall, accent shifting closer to Sfinkles. After the weekly Brie and Chianti tastings, Pinch closes the door to his one bedroom, reading the church sign again. After several weeks, he has a visitor, Widgeon, last seen a decade earlier, clinging to Bear's leg in Larchmont. Today she's an overweight 17-year-old in an excess of makeup, who is considering colleges for next year, with far more anxiety than hope. It was Birdie, a qualified vet now, married, living in North Carolina, who arranged this visit. She keeps Pinch informed on their extended family in irregular, funny letters. With typical snark, she explained that their half-sister lacks smarts or a good education. Might Evanlode be an option? He escorts Widgeon around campus, shows her his office. "Any questions? Don't be shy." She shakes her head vigorously. as if he'd requested that she summarize Kissinger's strategy on China while performing a Nadia Comaneci floor routine.
Ask me anything, even if it sounds silly, even if...
The office phone rings. Before answering, he tells her, I keep getting calls for the last guy who was here. He picks up, saying, Greg has left the department.
Who? What?
Dad? Pinch says. How did you get this number?
Widgeon hurries to her feet at the mention of their father. Dad, you know who's here with me? She came for a visit of...
Bear says. Your mother died.
For an instant, Pinch detaches, his eyes drawing in light, brain incapable of translating it. Ears deafened, sensing only a plastic phone receiver. Lips dry, hands cold, nauseous saliva under his tongue. He stares across his desk, Widgeon waving for a term with Daddy.
I'm sorry to say, Charlie, that, she did it to herself. Stupid goddamn thing.
Solemnly, Bear explains how he heard that Cecil tracked him down through the Petros Gallery.
What do you mean? Pinch says, not able to grasp or care how Bear came to know.
What do you mean?
He opens his eyes wider for a clearer reality than this. The horror repeats, as if he weren't informed once, but learns anew with each pulse of consciousness, falling from an aeroplane, spinning in somersaults down.
I don't understand.
Jumping in place, Widgeon beams at him.
Let me speak to Papa!
Bear states facts that accumulate like a highway pile-up. Nothing reaching Pinch, although the images will never leave him.
6 days on the floor before they walked in. And a plastic bag over her head.
When he puts down the phone, Widgeon is crestfallen.
Why didn't I get to talk to him?
Something happened. Pinch says, standing.
Okay, but still, she says, softly.
Pinch leads her from the department, points her towards the train station, unable to react when her angry tears brim.
I have to leave now?
She says.
Sorry.
Alone at his apartment, Pinch stands under the shower for so long that the hot water runs out, the spray thinning to a dribble, then pelting down icily. He gasps, not allowing himself to escape the cold. An hour later, he remains nude, sitting on the closed toilet. Teeth chattering, this thudding horror. He covers his eyes with a towel, looks at the darkness. Natalie looks back, shrugs. When he reaches her flat in London, Pinch washes all the dirty dishes, careful that no crockery touches, as if the slightest ding would crack him. He attempts to arrange a funeral, but finds only a few numbers in her phone book. When he calls them, a few don't even recognize the name.
Sorry, who died?
Others feign distress and sympathy, clearly just wanting the gossip.
What happened exactly?
Finally, Cecil intervenes, asking if a funeral service is absolutely necessary. And so, Natalie is cremated. The urn awaits pickup. After a few days, he forces himself to deal with her bedroom, on whose floor Natalie died. He opens her closet, dresses swaying. He gathers summer hats, empties her underwear drawer, pausing at the bedside table, her bifocals on the purple silk ribbon. He opens a rubbish bag. But hours later, Pinch remains cross-legged on the floor, studying artifacts, nothing discarded.
What is my objective here? To respect her privacy, or limit my pain, or preserve something of Natalie?
Accomplishing one aim violates another. Before this, she never took much interest in her pottery, so she never gave him any. Now he owns it all. Picking up one of her recent ceramic sculptures, he holds it under varied light, wary of doing it harm. His limbs don't feel wholly under his control lately. He envisages releasing the piece, watching it fall ever so slowly, smash fast. He rests it on the floor alongside the others and lies beside them, watching her ceiling, hearing neighbors' footsteps, listening to her darkness falling. He turns on a lamp and surveys the pottery forest. Her sculptures are not as he imagined, not quirky and disordered.
They're mashed lumps of clay, Pinchy, she said last summer. Gestural craziness from your crazy mother.
He presses his hands hard into his throat, recalling that meeting, understanding it now as their last. These sculptures are not as she described. They're elegant arcs, the clay raw on one side, glazed on the reverse, slashed in stone green and pebble blue, each piece hand-built, eerily smooth, frail. None of her works will sit in the museum, he knows. Natalie toiling through the night, or building slow pieces at her solitary workshop, or looking at him from her potter's wheel in Rome. She was disregarded, and will remain so forever, among the billions whose inner lives clamour, then expire, never to earn the slightest notice. What reason is there to care about any art if nobody but I will ever care about these? Cecil agrees to store the pottery that Pinch is unable to transport back to America. Even without a funeral, Pinch says by phone to his mother's friend, it'd be good to see you again.
We must do that. In person one day.
Pinch wishes the old potter would invite him to Brighton. Cecil was her sole friend in this country. There is only silence on the phone line.
I feel that I need to talk about her, Pinch adds, with someone who knows her, knew her, another time.
I shall look forward to it, Charles. Towards week's end, Pinch finally fills the rubbish bags, all in a hurry, trying not to view the contents, throwing in her bifocals, clay-streaked jeans and ragged T-shirts, an unfinished Iris Murdoch novel, her place marked with a ticket stub from a concert of Schumann piano sonatas on the night of her death, before she returned to this quiet room, hearing nothing beyond herself. On this same floor she lay, tied a plastic bag over her head. He shuts his eyes. Plastic sucked in at each breath. Outside he lowers the rubbish into the metal bins with utmost care, but he can't leave it. He stands in place, mind stalled, until a stranger passes and nods. Pinch nods back and returns inside, her purple silk bifocals ribbon saved in his pocket. 39. Pinch returns to Evanlode with three pots, an early Natalie fruit bowl, a tea mug, a ceramic sculpture. He offered to send a few pieces to Ruth, but she was too upset to accept. When he informed her of Natalie's death, the line cut, she just put down the receiver. He called back and she was shouting, too distraught to hear.
She wouldn't do this! She would not do this!
The line went dead again. Back at Evanlode, Pinch resumes his studies, coasting numbly down the path to a doctorate. In the department he agrees to any request, whether it's attending wine tastings or teaching freshman Italian classes. He acts cordial, as a buffer against damage. During dinner parties he looks directly at strangers, as he hasn't easily done since before puberty, yet his gaze is bland now, matched with bland smiles, never the slightest dispute, giving him a reputation on campus as an insubstantial man. Towards the end of that first academic year, he travels to Manhattan by train, needing to see Barrows. For hours he crisscrosses Central Park, glancing over his shoulder for muggers, almost wanting one, which would excuse him from stepping foot inside the Institute of Fine Arts. But there is no mugger, only a drug pusher in bug-eye sunglasses and crop-top football jersey watching him, plus couples bounding past in tracksuit tops and white shorts, part of the jogging craze. Distracted by watching the runners pound by, he realizes why he travelled here. He wants to tell Barrows about his mother and the inescapable image of Natalie on the floor in her London flat, which flashes through him during faculty gatherings. If he tells Barrows, it'll sound like a bid for pity. Perhaps it is. He never even introduced them. If they'd met, Pinch could justify approaching her with the news. But he was ashamed of Natalie. He halts.
I'm moving here, Dodo!
A runner barks, thudding past. Instantly, Pinch's pulse is fluttering, as if he'd been threatened with violence. He thrusts his hands into the pockets of his windbreaker, reminded that he has nothing to offer Barrows. He tucks his head down and returns to the train station. In his second year at Evanlode, Pinch speaks rarely to his father, unable to deal with Bear's ego or to sustain throwaway remarks about Natalie. Pinch passes nights in the company of Martina, an Argentine grad student of comparative literature, a left-wing activist back home. She left Buenos Aires when the military took over, and she struggles with the American college lifestyle. After 6 months together, Pinch mentions Natalie's death, stating for the first time that both his mother and his grandfather took their lives. He sees her thinking, "You too?" Instead, she only says, "Only happy words in this room." Things happen to her back home, and she cannot tolerate others' sorrows. He is with her to speak Spanish, to drink wine, even if she's the only one doing the serious drinking, to sleep together sometimes, the pretense of connection. Now and then he drives to suburban Philadelphia to visit the closest major museum, the collections at the Barnes Foundation. He recalls what Barrows once claimed of its founder, that the man made his fortune from gonorrhea treatment and spat on paintings to wipe off bits he disliked. Pinch wonders if it's true, and asks a guard, earning a blank stare. In Center City, he visits a giant new public sculpture, Clothespin, by Kleis Oldenburg, wondering if it's good, unsure what that means to him anymore. He watches people, creating thought paintings, man bores wife who wants to read, or girl shouting as bus pulls away. With a pocket-sized Kodak Instamatic, Pinch lingers behind lampposts, snapping street shots, speed-walking from captured objects. Once he sneaks a picture of a hoodlum, only for the guy's crew to surround him, demanding what in fuck he's doing, until they realize he's just a coward and relent. The best photos, of bodies turning, eyes half-closed, motifs midway, Pinch enlarges. He pursues the instant before, or a fraction too late, the thinnest slivers of experience. Using a loop, he studies strangers' faces, speaking aloud to them, copying their features in pencil and ink compositions, so large that they become abstracted in his sketchpad. But these drawings irritate him. They lack everything. A balanced, complete, all human drives cancelled. He scrunches each picture, jams it among the food scraps in his kitchen rubbish. After 5 years have passed at Evanlode, the seasons are too familiar to Pinch, as is his daily walk to the department. Freshmen still perturb him. They're incapable of walking properly, forcing him to slalom. In the mirror, Pinch detects a frown, believing he wasn't making one, only to recognize that this expression is now fixed on his brow. Evanlode was to be a way station, yet he's remained longer than most of his peers. The grad students he met early, Martina included, have accepted academic postings elsewhere, or taken civilian jobs. Many have started families. More than once, Pinch has brought flowers to a maternity ward, which always recalls the day when Barrow's roommate went into early labor. How old will that child be now? Once he and Barrow's had a conversation under the bedclothes, he consenting to her plan for one daughter, an only child, which suited their ambitions. Whenever he passes a pushchair, he peers in, wondering about these tiny humans. He'll sweep aside his comb-over and consider the limpid-eyed, bobble-headed occupant of the pushchair. Pinch wiggles his eyebrows, suddenly conscious of how his rubbery adult face must appear. "Hello, little one," he says, then a kindly nod to the parent, and quickly onward. To satisfy his doctoral advisor, Pinch loads his thesis with extraneous material about Venetians inventing flat crystal glass in the late 15th century, which increased the popularity of self-portraits, Lacan's theory of the mirror stage, Alberti's remarks in Trattoro della Pittura about the reflected face of Narcissus in water as a foundational myth of painting, Caravaggio's Narcissus as an allusion to mirror use in the High Renaissance. He will submit to any change sought and composes letters of obsequious thanks, anything to escape here. He orders 3 copies of his bound thesis from a local printing press, mailing one to Barrows, an adjunct professor at Princeton, according to the bio on the back of her first book, Losing Lily Briscoe, Women and Myth from Gentileschi to Nocklin, just published by Yale University Press. The 2nd copy he mails to Marsden's last known address in Toronto. The 3rd he mails to his father, now living in Maine with his present girlfriend. Pinch awaits the call, needing to hear his father's opinion on work that, years back, was initiated for Bear. This, Pinch knows, is why he persisted with his dissertation, for this solitary review. He will ask Dad if he should seek a publisher, a small press perhaps, or he could set up as an independent scholar outside the college ecosystem so he'd stand apart, able to express unpopular ideas like those he and Bear always talked about. He hears nothing, so places the call himself. Bear's girlfriend assures Pinch that the package did arrive. "Still sitting here on the console table. Could you tell him I'd love to know his thoughts as soon as he can, as soon as is feasible, given work?" A week passes. Another. A 3rd. Pinch orders himself to be patient. His mind keeps flipping back to the same subject. In bed, he rages over the wait. Finally, he calls Maine again. Gets Dad on the line this time. Talks about unrelated subjects, then shoots out his question.
"Kiddo, you should be proud as hell of what you've done."
Beaming, Pinch leans forward, then rocks back, reaching for the pipe. He grasps it, thrusts it in air, shaking his fist.
"I'm so glad to hear this, Dad. I feel lightened, completely. I wanted to tell you I've been thinking about your biography again. You have so many amazing stories. I could be your stenographer. It'd be a way forward for me. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to get into an Ivy League. I'm sorry about that. But you saw this piece of writing and it was okay, right? What do you think? I'd come out there if that works, or we could meet elsewhere, wherever suits you.
Hold the line. Jenny's waving at me. What is it, sweetheart? Yeah, just finishing up. It's Charlie, the Italian one. Yep, that one. 10 seconds, babe. Charlie, you were saying my undivided attention.
So it was decent, the thesis?
He needs replenishing.
Hell of a lot of work you did. Solid work.
There are loads of your ideas in there. Did you notice?
I'm still waiting for my commission.
In haste, Pinch lights his pipe. Coughs.
And you saw the dedication?
Folks dedicate doctors nowadays?
It was on the first page. You didn't see that?
He pauses.
Dad, I know you've been busy at the studio lately, but did you get a chance to read the whole thing yet?
Ah, what do I know about essays? What counts is that you celebrate tonight. It's a hell of an accomplishment, what you did. You know, most fathers worry that their kids are doing too much celebrating at college. I worry you're not doing enough. You need to raise a glass to yourself, kiddo.
I'm on my second mint tea already, Pinch says, attempting to play along, lifting his mug as if for Bear's perusal. Drinking from one of Mum's ceramics, actually. It took me ages to use this. I've got tons of her pottery in storage with Cecil. Could I get him to send you a few pieces, Dad?
Poor Natty.
You always liked her work.
Whenever I saw your mother's art, I thought one thing. She wants to please. I felt that way. No, her pieces were never really first class. That's why I always...
Pinch hangs up, then raises the receiver, hand shaking, needing to smash the phone against the wall. But he's afraid of harm, of damage, of missing Dad's return call. In fact, Bear doesn't call back. Pinch was planning to propose moving to Maine, finding a place nearby, so they could start on the biography. He pulls open the fridge door, hard enough that it slams against the cupboard, shuddering jars. Off cold shelves he grabs at anything, gorging himself nearly to suffocation. Eyes watering, he dry heaves into the sink, grasps the metal tap with both hands, rows it violently back and forth, unable to snap it. He punches the wall at full force and howls from the pain. A dent in the whitewash. He hits it again, a red smear, his knuckles throbbing, dripping blood on the linoleum. He is unable to catch air. Not done yet, he says, body quaking, eyes blinking. I'm not done yet.
Adulthood. Oil on canvas. 96 by 182 inches. Courtesy of the Bavinsky Estate. London, 1981. 40. Under thunderous rain, Pinch hurries down a muddy path, squelching after the elderly man who marches briskly ahead.
I'm getting a little soaked, Cecil. Could we take cover, if that's okay?
Throughout the years, Pinch has often reflected on the noble hermit of his childhood, a man who ploughed ahead with his pottery, irrespective of the world's taste. After Natalie died, they spoke by phone but didn't meet until today. Cecil arrived in his Morris Minor, outside Pinch's rented flat near Belsize Park, returned the stored boxes of Natalie's pottery, and said, "Shall we walk?" So they find themselves here, on an ill-judged hike across Hampstead Heath, during which Pinch has seen little but the back of the man's waxed barber coat. Cecil veers off track, tramping towards the closest road, where he directs Pinch into a drab cafe, shakes off the raindrops, and points to a table. Tea arrives in chipped cups, the saucers slopping with milky brew. Cecil betrays no unease, but Pinch feels it, so tosses forth questions, each dropping like a dead fly between them.
Is it even wetter than this in Brighton?
Cecil sweeps aside his grey-blonde fringe, a plop of rain landing in his tea.
It rather varies on the time of year.
Pinch copies Cecil, sweeping across his own hair as if readying for the school photo. A 31-year-old teenager with bad skin and thinning locks, damp tweed jacket, pipe in breast pocket. He smiles, willing Cecil to mirror his warmth. Pinch is fond of this man who, in his small way, kept an eye on Natalie, no matter how difficult she could be. Pinch won't confess it yet, but this recent move back to England was partly to assume his mother's bond with Cecil. For weeks, Pinch has awaited this meeting, needing counsel from the wise old potter, to hear how to salvage a bungled young life. Sitting opposite Cecil, however, Pinch speaks only of Natalie.
"What did you make of her work?" Pinch asks.
"She was quite skilled.
Why do you think other people weren't interested?"
"Oh, there's very limited acclaim in ceramics.
But she was good, right? People should have paid more attention to her work, no?"
For a spell, Cecil remains silent. His sight line sweeps above Pinch's head,
as if a plane with a banner were dragging his response across the sky, though it's just an insect scuttling over the cafe window.
"What is has never been what ought," Cecil answers finally. "You pose an is-ought question. When I was younger, I dabbled in oughts. I have retired to is."
He sips his tea soundlessly. Pinch rests his jittery hands on the table, steepling his fingers, which he never does, only to notice that Cecil is himself making this gesture. Pinch reaches for the napkin dispenser, but finds Cecil's long, tapering fingers doing the same. "Sorry, but you first," Pinch says, embarrassed by this compulsive mimicry, so useful in acquiring foreign words, so obstructive in expressing his own.
"You had further questions about Natalie?" "I feel," Pinch begins, "I have this feeling that what happened with her involved me in some way."
Unable to look across the table, he gives a forced laugh.
"Oh, it's madness. What I said? Or what she did? You can't dwell on it. That's all I can do."
Cecil wriggles higher in his seat, as if to signal an end to melancholy talk.
"Tell me, what news of the Great Bear?"
Pinch wants anything but to speak of his father. Cecil launches into reminiscences of that charming meal together in Rome, declaring himself awfully grateful to Bear for having bought that vast electric kiln at the cottage, not to mention having later taken the entire property off his bankrupt hands.
"And he's as productive as ever, is he? And still represented by the Petros Gallery? Very, very fashionable place. How is Bear's press? Journalists must be a bore."
"Dad holds his own."
"Why?" Pinch wonders. "Must I reflexively puff my father? Has a single reporter approached my father in years?"
When one of Bear's early paintings came up at a minor auction house last year, the lot went unsold.
"But how?" Cecil persists, shaking the last drop of tea into his mouth. "How would you say his work is selling?"
Pinch rambles about the scarcity of museum acquisitions since the oil crisis, how private galleries only care about selling wall meat to financiers these days, and corporations are busy bejeweling their headquarters with slabs of Jasper Johns, Diane Arbus, Modigliani.
"Yes, yes," Cecil resumes. "What does a good Mavinsky go for today?"
Pinch is taken aback. Why should Cecil, who chose a poor man's trade, lust at the pornography of another man's wealth? Perhaps because Cecil took the noble path, finding only hunger at its end. An artist's noble vision isn't enough, Pinch realizes. He must succeed. And he reads the old potter before him with plunging clarity that only manners brought Cecil here.
"Looks like the rain is stopping," Cecil remarks.
Shortly he stands, shakes hands, pays up. Pinch watches the waxed barber coat stride away for good. This cherished artist, requiring only his tools, caring nothing for the world's wants, he doesn't exist. Perhaps no such person ever has. Readying to leave the cafe himself, Pinch glimpses himself reflected in the window, mud on his shoes, caked up the hem of his corduroys. Cecil was the last person to view him, so that man's impression holds sway. A son of my sad Canadian friend, an unattractive boy, testing my courtesy, so ferociously wanting something, wanting someone.
41. Pinch awakens with a start, breathing heavily, shaking off another nightmare about poverty. For years he subsisted with the help of his grandmother, scholarships, teaching stipends, but he moved to London with scant savings, no job, no friends, and the expectation that Cecil would somehow resolve it all. Instead, Pinch has rent payments upcoming and a fast dwindling bank account. London itself seems harsher than he left it, with a thin surface of civility covering deep pools of aggression. During his decade away, there were race riots and power cuts, IRA bomb threats, everyone going on strike, from the gravediggers to the bakers to the hospital staff. The bad-tempered ripples persist, with Mrs. Thatcher pointedly extolling those who succeed, those with a ferocity for profit and the sharp elbows to achieve it, much the traits that Pinch lacks. Wandering around his neighborhood, he walks slowly, apprehensively. Then crossing the street, he must hurry across the roadway as drivers hurtle murderously towards him, perfectly willing to maim a stranger to make a point about the rules. Even the kids in polyester school uniforms disconcert him, marauding down the high streets, shrieking out as if to raise two fingers at the plodding grown-ups whom they must someday become. Pinch will not ask for money from Ruth or Bear. He sends copies of a speculative letter to art history departments across southern England and Wales. Nobody responds. Checking the master copy of that letter,
Pinch sees with mortification that he professed himself moist grateful for their consideration, and they moist certainly grant him none. As a stopgap measure, he takes freelance work translating technical documents. The pay is low, and tallied by the page, so he must work from first light, forking drippy fried egg between his lips, scanning his daily allotment. By dinner, he's done 12 hours. His only human contact, the sound of footsteps from the flat above. When he bumps into those neighbors outside the building, he greets them with inflated cheer, hoping to precipitate a conversation. They smile briefly, keep walking. So Pinch must take his companionship more stealthily, eavesdropping when on the London Underground. He lingers amid the pub-leaving throng at a local chippy, handling a newspaper cone of breaded cod, drizzle painted with tomato sauce, the malt vinegar wrinkling cryptic crosswords and editorials damning the miners. By far his closest relationship is with the Bengali clerks at Imperial Foods, which he visits for pipe tobacco and Maltesers. All his daily pleasures and most of his meals derive from there. He chats with shelf stockers, restores products misplaced by other customers, commiserates after a skinhead smashes the window, and calls them fucking packies, which is geographically incorrect, Pinch notes, in addition to being disgusting. When a new cashier is hired, Pinch makes his status at the shop known to her, asking after the owner by name. As she packs his items, the paper bag tips, a misshapen grapefruit lolloping down the checkout lane. He tosses it in the air, muffing the catch, and reads the name tag. Julie M., pinned to her orange jumper. She is distracted and takes a pen from her apron, notes something in her palm. At the exit, Pinch pauses. What did you write before? I'm just curious. Write? In your hand. She opens her palm for him to see. He approaches, squints at the smudged ink, which reads, Go-chut. What language is that? It's... She looks for the manager, not around, so digs into Pinch's shopping bag, taking out a jar. That. Again she displays her palm, and he makes out two faded words. Mango chutney. Julie, a recent arrival to the capital from the north of England, hasn't tried this product or many others in the shop. Would you like to? He twists the lid, but grunts, reddening, unable to take it off. Smiling sweetly, she insists he not bother. The expression transforms her. In repose, she was tired and middle-aged, but becomes a little girl when smiling. She must be around his age, perhaps a tad older, with caramel-brown curls framing confectionery eyes. A wide, strong frame, soft, without being curvaceous. Julie M. is not beautiful. He experiences a rush of need for her. Julie explains that she wants to be more adventurous, especially now that she works at Mr. Khan's shop. So, that evening, he collects her outside Imperial Foods, and leads her to a reserved table at the Taj Mahal, where Pinch explains the menu at length, only then daring to ask about her. Hailing from a town near Newcastle-upon-Tyne, she moved south only recently, after her marriage ended and she couldn't find work there. Pinch mentions having read newspaper articles about the dire situation in the north, that it's so bad mothers and wives are taking the train to King's Cross and turning tricks behind the station. We're not all on the game, you know, she says. Oh, no, God, no. Pinch responds, mortified, neck blotching. I didn't mean to suggest that. Sorry, it just meant how bad it is. I'd call myself lucky to have this job at Imperial. It's a foothold. A foothold for something else? I hope so. Don't know what yet. What would you do? He asks, leaning forward, if you could do anything. Me? I'd probably read all day. If it has words, Julie tells him, she'll be at it, from a cereal box to a Dickens. She asks about his line of work, evidently impressed to meet a translator, which emboldens Pinch. She laments knowing only English, and asks how many languages he speaks. Could you say a bit for me? In which one? All of them. He offers a few remarks in Italian, speaking with formality, saying it's a very pleasant evening, that he hopes she enjoys it. How'd you go at sounding foreign like that? She says, admiringly. Give us some more, then. He speaks a few lines in French, then Spanish, then German, braver as he goes, daring to say how much he likes her. What's all that mean? It's just things from work. You like your work, then, the translating? Depends, can be a slog, but sometimes, yes, I like coming across words I never knew existed, that's the best part. There are tons, even in English, that I didn't know, such as... absturge. That's not English. It means to wipe clean, like you do with a wound before surgery. I would not. He laughs. It's from Middle French, by way of Latin. Sorry, I'm getting boring. Throw a samosa at me when I do that. I should do if you hadn't eaten them all, greedy booger. He suppresses the electric thrill of this, that he's dining with a woman, that he just asked her out, that she works at the best shop in London. This had better go well, or where do I buy milk?
But I'm mad, he adds, because it's not like I can ever use these words where nobody understands them. She rises to find the toilet, her grin bearing a gap between her front teeth.
Pardon me, she tells him. I always absturge my hands before pudding.
Alone at the table, he continues to view her seat.
This is what I want to dedicate myself to. This.
After a mere hour in her company, he has lost any understanding of his years obsessing about art, posterity, failure. She seems truly intrigued by him. There's nothing cynical about Julie. Perhaps that's it. He recalls a remark she made. You survive off your wits. That recast in an instant how he perceived his entire life to date. Before, he'd planned to badger more universities with applications. Seated here, he throws off that future. He'll take this future, even if he doesn't know what it means. Me, alone in the world, braving it. Though he's emboldened to go it alone only by dint of not being alone tonight. In a passing glimmer, he imagines sex with Julie, his hands on her hips, her breasts under the bra, his thighs against hers.
Stop that. Too far ahead of yourself.
And here she is. Over dessert, Julie speaks of her family, noting that she comes from working people.
Everyone is so preoccupied with the class system here, he says.
You do realize that we've got a queen?
Yes, I often run into her waiting for the tube.
Smiling, she nudges his spoon out of the way to reach their mango kulfi.
In this country, a person speaks two words and you know where they're from, what their schooling was.
You're lucky you are. You don't have that with your nice American accent.
Canadian.
See? I didn't even know.
Back when I used to teach, I always...
You were a teacher?
Only during my doctorate. Very junior classes in art history, plus Italian.
So you're qualified as a doctor, too?
Not the useful kind. Not the kind that absturges.
Flushed from lager and expectation, he looks directly at her. From his perspective, she has experienced a life so much fuller than his. Raised three younger sisters and a brother. Married a hard drinker, whom she supported by working as a cutter at a garment factory, where blokes gave the girls cuddles, like it or not. Got divorced when Ben's boozing became too much. Moved down here to London. By contrast, Pinch's life, so fumbling in his view, seems to Julie as sparkling and exotic as his foreign words.
You're my bit of posh, she tells him, and I'm your bit of rough.
42. Pinch's basement flat is small for two, and would test another couple. But the better he knows Julie, her pudgy grin upon waking, her tone-deaf singing, the more Pinch is lifted from his crusty, professorial manner. Often he praises her mind and criticizes the state education forced on her in childhood, implying that she could make more of herself. A person can still study at age 34. When she enrolls at Birkbeck College, he deems this the relationship of his life. She esteems his view. After classes, Julie returns, bubbling with big talk on big subjects, making insightful, innocent links among literature and sociology and philosophy. Listening, rapt, Pinch feels his love galloping ahead. After a snotty man lampoons her questions in class, Pinch orders her to ignore bullies like that. You're the smartest person there by miles, I promise, Jules. He's actually pretty clever, always talking about everyone's subjectivity. Subjectivity is just an underhand way to attack other people. I'm sure he is entirely objective, right? He's preening for attention, I assure you.
Pinch stops, sheepish suddenly.
Sorry, I'm frothing at the mouth.
No, I'm enjoying the show.
She smiles.
Enjoy this, then.
He pulls up his shirt, slaps his gut.
Look at this monstrosity. How did I gain so much weight? I've become disgusting.
Yes, but you're my disgusting, she teases. You know, I wouldn't mind a big tummy. They're not hard to achieve. I call it the Maltese's diet.
Like a pregnant belly?
Oh, that's a bit insulting, he says, laughing, petering out as he digests a remark.
Julie delayed a family because of her ex and his drinking. She lost years because of that, and doesn't have endless time. He ponders the features of their child, but keeps seeing the daughter he's previously imagined, little Barrows. He pulls down his shirt.
When you're further along with your degree, we can think of kids. If we took that step now, it'd be the end.
Not the end of steps, just a different one, she contends.
Charlie, don't think I know nothing because I don't know Latin.
Julie, everyone I ever met who knew Latin, me especially, knows fuck all.
He fetches a sausage roll from the fridge, eats standing, knowing why he rebuffed her. He loves Julie, but he isn't sure he accepts her. She isn't accomplished, isn't expecting to become important, which reinforces that he isn't, and won't be. Wincing at his disloyalty, he shoves the sausage roll back into the fridge, slams the door. "Grumpy?" she asks. "Just some work things on my mind." In the bathroom, he brushes his hair roughly across his balding pate, holds in his tummy as if an attractive stranger passed. He makes himself relax, looking directly at the reflection, jabbing his stomach with a toothbrush end, repelled by himself, needing Julie, though she is just on the other side of this door. When her sister visits London, she wants to do a bit of Oxford Street window shopping without her kids, so Julie and Pinch take the two youngsters to the National Gallery, with Pinch acting as impromptu tour guide, pointing them towards famous paintings, explaining historical context, the tragedies and quirks of artists, embedded symbols, the technical choices that direct the eye or acknowledge predecessors. As Natalie once taught him at Galleria Borghese, he shows these kids to crouch before the pictures to catch a raking light, revealing outlines of the underpainting, where one discovers what the artists intended, in contrast to what they achieved. And what a person intends is as important as what they achieve, don't you think?
"Are those mushrooms, Uncle Charlie?"
the 11-year-old girl asks, pointing at the foreground of the Wilton diptych.
"Good eye, Liz. They were long thought by people less sharp than you to be flowers, but they've since been identified as aniseed toadstools and mushroom caps, very rare medieval depictions of mushrooms which appear much more frequently after 1500.
Bemused, the two kids run off to see a picture of soldiers fighting, and Julie goes with them. Following after, Pinch considers her from behind, knowing her soft body beneath that dress, a secret knowledge, a mission to her, that moves him, causes him to act sternly with the children at their next inquiry, because stern is the opposite of what he feels. 43. Bear Bavinsky has soured on matrimony. His latest ended in divorce, with Elodie contesting ownership of his entire art production, the paintings he labored on for decades and kept, those that survived his scathing judgment, and which have held out all this time, awaiting a call from the great museums. Eventually she settled for a hefty lump of cash, but the close call unnerved Bear. He moved all his works to a private storage location in Europe, away from the rats, as he refers to anyone who dares meddle with his hoard.
"I know you're not enthused about weddings right now, Dad, but could you be persuaded to attend one if you weren't the sucker in question? If it was me?"
"Charlie boy,"
he responds, dropping the phone in enthusiasm, grabbing it again and apologizing.
Was that the first time, Pinch thinks, that Dad has said sorry to me?
"Happiest news I ever heard, kiddo. Congratulations, son. Who's the lucky lady?"
Pinch purposely kept details of Julie from his father. Now he pours them out, with Bear's enthusiasm serving to confirm his own, assuring Pinch that he loves her. After the call, he finds Julie doing the dishes and kisses her.
"Let me finish. You call your sister."
Julie leaps off to do so, spreading the happy news. After rinsing the last knife, Pinch turns off the tap and catches a snippet of her conversation in the other room.
"Not weak at the knees, Queenie. It's hard to explain."
Pinch tries not to mind. He can hardly expect to stir a woman's passions. He knows what Julie likes about him. He's from a world more appealing than this dreary country, where her father is still fulminating about the strike-breaking scabs, her mum worries about the broken boiler, her brother spends his days at the new video slot machine in his local pub. Lately, Julie talks about leaving England and setting up overseas, Australia maybe. He flips through the atlas in bed. She tests him on capitals.
"Wagadougou," he answers.
"How'd you know that, Charlie?"
She flicks off the light, not for romance, but to dream open-eyed beside her foreign bloke. A month before the ceremony, Pinch checks that Dad has his travel booked. Bear is finishing an important painting before flying over, and it's hard to know when he'll be done. It'd be crazy to buy a flight when there's a chance he'll be tied up. Pinch nods. He never entirely expected his father. "Either way, you'll be here in spirit. We'll raise a glass to you."
"A glass? Hell, a bottle at least. Here's what, kiddo, I'm sending over a case of champagne."
The event takes place at a register office with Julie's friends and family, plus Mr. Khan from Imperial Foods, and a huge bouquet from Birdie, who's about to give birth in North Carolina so can't make it. After the formalities, husband and wife step out into a drizzle, Pinch looking skyward, a droplet hitting his eye. He blinks, seeing Julie in a blur. "Nice weather for ducks," she says, and he lifts his new spouse off her feet,
prompting her to wave theatrically, damsel in distress. Out of breath, he puts her down, presses his face to hers, the coolness of her powdered cheek against his warm temple. "It's just you and me," she whispers. "Well, for now," he responds, catching her eye.
44. A honeymoon is beyond their means, so they spend a week vacationing at home, starting with a fancy Italian meal prepared by Pinch. It'll be indulgence for days, with cakes and wine, reading in bed, sleeping late. He's a little embarrassed to have promised a case of champagne, which never arrives. As the months pass, Pinch thinks more about having children of their own. In the past, when Julie hinted at starting a family, he dismissed the topic, speaking of finances. Couldn't afford a baby, me as a freelance translator, you part-time cashier, part-time student. But lately, to himself, Pinch brushes aside all objections. He stops in the middle of the pavement, ruminating. Julie always depicted him as an intellectual of range and experience, yet she is catching up. Already she knows plenty of professors more erudite and sophisticated than he. When she takes him on a trip to her hometown, he wants to treat her parents to dinner out. But it turns out that going for dinner strikes them as a showy extravagance. They come only to a shabby French restaurant to accommodate him, turning out in their Sunday best, worried about garlic, disliking most of the funny tastes. To make matters worse, Pinch cuts himself shaving before they set out, and the nick won't stop bleeding throughout dinner. When the bill comes, Julie's father insists on paying. This was not the agreement, but the man, in his early 60s with a craggy ancient face of 100, is offended by Pinch's insistence. On the train to London, he recalls sitting beside Bear when they returned from New York City to Dad's wife and kids in the suburbs. He leans to Julie's ear. "I need to discuss something."
"In whispers?"
"Yes," he says, smiling.
"Thinking about your nephew and niece."
"What about them?"
"Just thinking. I don't know."
He pauses.
"About a little person to join us?"
He leans back to see her eyes.
"You don't seem overwhelmed by the prospect."
"We agreed. Not now." That was more than a year ago. His proposition, a source of doubt for Pinch until he spoke it seconds ago, feels like an urgent need now.
"I wrote a list of baby names,"
he says to lighten the mood.
Or perhaps cajole her.
"Charlie, I got so much studying ahead. You know that."
"Yes, fine,"
he responds, hurt now. "I thought you wanted them. Don't put me on trial here."
"But you said that, no?"
"Can't I change my mind?"
"Then why did we marry?"
"When do I have time to do anything, even to breathe?"
"Can't we breathe on weekends?"
She doesn't laugh.
Neither does he.
After this trip, they have sex less often. Each interruption to fetch contraception has become a weighted minute. Often they don't resume. Julie has taken a step away from him, which makes him step forward, which causes her to back off once more, a two-step that becomes more strained as the months pass.
"You are on the phone forever," he complains.
"Why do you hate it when I speak to friends?"
"Talk to anyone you like. Just, I thought we were going to watch something on TV."
"Forget it, Jules. Could you be quiet coming to bed?"
"Always am."
But he doesn't leave.
"Meet me under the covers?"
"I'm doing homework, Charlie."
"Homework so pressing that you talked for 2 hours with Ben?"
"That wasn't 2 hours. What makes you think it was Ben?"
"Wasn't it?"
he says, despising himself. She and her ex-husband remain close. They grew up together, and you don't forget that. He stopped drinking recently and is going through a vulnerable patch. When those two speak, Pinch hears her Geordie accent strengthening, her laughter echoing from the other room, the lights off in there. When he walks in, flicking on the lamp, she looks elsewhere, with reddest, joyful cheeks. He and Julie squabble nowadays, and they never used to. It's as if he were prodding for something, her ardour, her desire, that cannot come from pushing. When she suggests that he take a break from grey London, that he visit his father's cottage in France, it leads to their umpteenth quarrel.
"I'm not angry, but please, Jules, stop advising me, okay?"
"I'm not advising you, and what's so bad if I did?" she says.
"Your father would let you stay, and you'd do well with a break, rather than stuck inside this flat all day translating rubbish about calculators."
"It's a computer manual, but thanks for the condescension," he adds.
"Maybe both of us could go."
He turns away fast, filling the kettle.
"I can't, Charlie, can't."
"You could practice for your French class." "France couldn't save the likes of me. Some brains don't absorb foreign languages."
Not true. Actually, you should be a teacher. What is the point here, sending me off to my dad's place? He says, voice raised, wavering, getting me out of your hair? If I don't want to go...